happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
He washed my sins away.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. And I welcome you. Today, we have an empowering hour. We always open with the latest on health and healing, how to live a longer life. Stress in older people increases the risk of pre-Alzheimer's conditions, according to Albert Einstein's School of Medicine. Then a plant compound in spices and herbs increases brain connection. Well, that's good news. That's from the Federal University in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And then are flame retardant chemicals fueling thyroid cancer? Duke University. Also, consuming ashwagandha root shows improvement in muscle strength, size, and recovery. For all people who want to have a stronger body, that's good information. And from Aju University in South Korea, vitamin D deficiency has a relationship with endothelial dysfunction and early Parkinson's, and a lot more on health and healing. Then from our public health segment today, the silent epidemic killing white American women. This is from Crawford Killen, and it's very important. It's a brand new report. In fact, it's so important that it took 6 pages in the recent issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And the title of the report is Rising Morbidity and Mortality in Midlife Among White Non-Hispanic Americans in the 21st century. So, why are young people dying when they're in their 30s and 40s, especially women? I'll get to that. Also, from Medical Express, a new study shows the drug overdose epidemic, top cause of U.S. injury deaths. We're talking about prescription drugs and also other drugs, but the prescriptions are the biggest killers. Lots of people dying. And vaccines may be worse than the disease. Who says this? An anti-vaxxer? No. Kyla Martin, a pro-vaccine person, is saying that the 69 doses a child receives before the age of 6, it's causing all kinds of problems. Also today from our audio clip file, we'll be listening to Vaccines in One Day, when a pro-vaccine person went along with the doctor's recommendations, what happened to their child. Also, George Carlin, pro-life is anti-woman. That's unusual. Let's hear what he has to say. And also, we want to hear from why Colonel Gaddafi was actually killed. Why did they need to destroy Libya? We've been given one set of reasons, but they make no sense. So we have a clip from a person who is one of the leaders in the progressive movement in Africa who will give us that. And also the one thing I like when I listen to these clips is that they frequently reveal a whole view of life that we don't see in the mainstream or alternative media. For example, who do we have today standing up against the people in the media? We don't. We rarely have anyone in the media who is there as an advocate for the average person. So when you watch Fox and you see Juan Williams as their so-called Democrat or liberal, he's no different than they are on almost all subjects. But where the people could really tell the person being interviewed, hey, you're wrong. We're going to have a clip like that. I think you'll find it interesting. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Also today, I had such a positive response to the program I did on what I believe is coming with economic collapse and what the signs are that we're not paying attention to. I'm going to be more specific today in a segment with two people in studio, Sharon Willems, an investigative journalist, and my brother Stephen, who's been an advocate for more than 30 years for the small business person. He does this as a volunteer, and we want to show you how bad it is for small businesses and their employees in a corrupt environment where the landlords own Albany and City Hall and the mayor's office in New York City. This is from Albert Einstein School of Medicine, published in Alzheimer's Disease and Associated Disorders. It says, quote, feeling stressed out, well, it increases the likelihood that elderly people will develop mild cognitive impairment, often a prelude to full-blown Alzheimer's disease. That's according to this new study. In fact, participants were twice as likely to become impaired than those who were not stressed out. Now, we know that stress is treatable. As a result, we don't need to be stressed, but we are. Almost 500,000 Americans are now being diagnosed officially with Alzheimer's dementia every year, and it's growing. It's going to be pandemic. I predict that within the next 10 years, when my generation, the baby boomers, when we start hitting retirement age and older, because we have not taken care of ourselves as a generation, we suffer from obesity, high blood pressure, cognitive decline, memory loss, fatigue, we have too much fat on our bellies, and we have arthritis and inflammatory conditions and diabetes, that all of that portends towards a higher incidence of dementia and Alzheimer's, which then means that we have to have someone take care of us, either in an institution, but there's no more rooms in institutions. They're all full. And it's very expensive. Well, then our sons and daughters have to take care of us. But that destroys their lives. If you doubt me, let me introduce you to some people I counsel who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who have no life, who are now sick themselves because they're taking care of a loved one 24/7. So what are we doing about this? How about nothing? Nothing to prevent it, nothing to look at the numbers of people affected, what it's going to cost, who's going to pay for it, nothing. So if we could just take a few things and emphasize that at the top of that list is stress. Now, it doesn't matter what the form of stress is. It could be in a relationship that's not working for you. You might be in a job you don't like. You could be looking at yourself in the mirror, not happy with what you see. You could see the loss of friendships or someone dies. Whatever is stressing you, it always impacts the body the same way. You have a rush of cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, catecholamines, and adrenaline. All of that then adversely affects your blood sugar, making you more susceptible to metabolic dysfunction. It also means that you're going to end up fatigued. Now, you do a blood workup, you won't find any cause. There won't be the viruses, the bacteria, because no one knows how to test for adrenal exhaustion. What is the single most important nutrient for your adrenal glands? Vitamin C. But the average American is not consuming vitamin C in adequate amounts. They're taking tiny little amounts based on completely unscientific principles of what is the amount of vitamin C we should consume to prevent scurvy, a classical form of vitamin C deficiency. What they do not consider is that the average person is overweight, that increase in vitamin C has inflammation, conditions, cancer, diabetes. That increases your need for vitamin C. Is unhealthy, that increases it. So if you were to take more vitamin C, and if each day you were to simply sit alone in a quiet place and just breathe deep and just be present in the environment you're in, I found one of the things I do, because I work so many hours a day when I'm in New York, and that's one of the reasons when I go home, I don't socialize ever. In 20 years, I've never gone to a party or a social event. I don't date anyone. I'm alone in my home because when I'm in New York, if you've noticed the other night after my lecture, 200 people came up and asking me questions. This is after we'd left the lecture hall, which was packed, by the way, a wonderful group of people. It was so much fun seeing so many people from the audience who really cared about life and health and were there to be motivated and get inspired and to start their journey, which I've got a lot of emails that they did. But afterwards, I spent the next 4 hours till 1 o'clock in the morning, one after the other, answering people's questions, trying to help them. And I'm happy to do that. But keep in mind, I start my day at 4. Now it's 1 in the morning. I've gone 21 straight hours. And I'm doing that almost every day. So when I'm not in the city, which is half the year, that's the time I commune with nature. What do? Well, I'll go out and I'll sit in a quiet place and I'll just be present. So whatever's in that moment is all that's in my mind for about a half hour. It doesn't take a long time. Do it a couple times a day. If I'm in the city, after my radio program, I'll walk over to a museum like the Frick on Fifth Avenue and 70th Street. It's one of the most beautiful fountains in America inside the Frick. And you just sit there on a bench and you just look at the water and you just feel the environment and it just totally de-stresses. Or I like to go up to the Museum of Natural History and look at some of their collections and just sit there and just observe. Or sit in front of a Thomas Cole painting or Frederick Church painting, some of the old Hudson Valley painters that are my favorite painters. Those are some of the classics. And just sit and be. Be present for the energy of that painting. But you could do it 100 other ways. Being in a butterfly garden. I watched this past summer when I did a retreat and there was a butterfly garden where you went into this environment and there were just butterflies. And people had all these butterflies just landing on them. They just totally de-stressed. Then I started watching how often in a day someone would go over to the butterfly. And I asked, what are you going there for? And this one guy says, look, I'm a banker. So every day they're stressed. When I go home, I'm stressed. People from work call me all the time. I've been called at 2 o'clock in the morning because someone wanted to know something. And because I'm their private banker, I have to make myself accessible. He said, so I'm just stressed to the max to sit here and have a monarch butterfly land on my shoulder. And I'm sitting there looking at it for a half hour. This was just perfect. So de-stress now. Find an environment where you can enjoy this, but it can't be with clutter and noise and people talking, alone time. So that's how we help these people early on in life, and especially younger people who think they're invincible. They're not, and they forget the day's going to come when everything finally becomes due. Okay, you've got your destination. Now, what lessons have you learned from the choices you've made that now get you to this destination and you're a mess? You're sick, you're overweight, you're depressed, you're anxious, you're insecure. Those are all based upon the choices we were given and choices we choose. So we can change. And it's always good if you have a support system to help you change. But make sure that your support system is not enabling you, but rather encouraging you to be the best you can be for yourself. Next up, plant compound found in spices and herbs increases brain connections. Well, boy, this is really good for the very condition I just mentioned, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. This is from the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And here's what it says. It says that they have demonstrated that apigenin, that's a substance found in parsley, thyme, chamomile, or in red pepper, improves neuron formation and strengthens the connections between brain cells. Now, previous experiments in animals have also shown that these substances and the chemical and also the flavonoids that are in all your fruits and vegetables positively affect memory and learning. And many studies highlight the potential of flavonoids to preserve and enhance brain function. And while the effectiveness of flavonoids for brain health is not an entirely new concept, This research is the first to show the positive effects of apigenin directly on human cells and the first to unravel its mechanisms. And this was published in Advances in Regenerative Biology. So the takeaway message here is simple. For those of you who are consuming your fruits and vegetables way ahead of the curve, wow, are you doing the right thing? For those of you who've gone from processed vegetables, canned vegetables, overly salted, dead and denatured, enzyme-deficient vegetables, to actually having fresh vegetables wherever possible, raw or lightly steamed to make them more bioavailable, well, then you're helping reconnect cells in the brain. For those of you who are drinking your juices each day, which more and more people are, then you're getting flooded with bioflavonoids and DNA reparative restorative chemicals. In one glass, 16 ounces, which is a relatively small glass, of mixed vegetables, you're getting around 500 or more different phytonutrients, including the ones I just mentioned, including the phytochemicals. That is restorative. That's actually repairing your DNA. It is helping to strengthen collagen, the connective tissue that keeps your skin tight and elastic. It helps in the rejuvenation process. So the more juices you have from a variety of sources, like some people can have grapefruit with lemon and lime, and others would like watermelon with lemon, and others would like beet and cucumber and celery. So the greater the variety, the healthier it is. Stay away from high concentrations of certain ones, because if you have too much of the, like kale and watercress and parsley, arugula, if it's too concentrated, that gives you more than what you can eat in that. You always dilute it. Always dilute it with celery and cucumber or green apple. Also, we have never paid attention to flame retardants. We think it's a good thing. After all, the retardant is there to keep a fire from happening. But according to Duke University, they're saying this, quote, environmental chemist Heather Stapleton and her collaborators have found that endocrine disruptors can contribute to thyroid cancer risk. And thyroid cancer is the fastest increasing cancer in the United States in both men and women. And Dr. Julia Sosa, professor of advanced oncology and GI surgery, and she's an authority on thyroid cancer, and right now she's lending her expertise to this great demand to know about why are we having thyroid cancer increasing. And this is what they're finding, that it's flame retardant chemicals. So that's in what? Well, it's in sofas, chairs, bedding, mattresses, in particle board, cabinets, just about everything the average person is using today. So what's the takeaway message that can help us? First and foremost, if you have no other resources and must continue to use what you have, as some would have, then get yourself a sealant. There are non-toxic sealants. They act like a varnish. But they're made from resins that do not outgas, but seal in the wood that would be outgassing. And so you wipe that in, and it covers the pores and whatever is outgassing so it doesn't come into the room. If it's carpet, then I would take up the carpet and put down flooring and have as much furniture or flooring or drapes that are without the flame retardant chemicals. And that can protect you. Also, finally, ashwagandha. It's a great root. I recommend it for a lot of different things. But according to the Journal of International Sports Nutrition, it improves muscle strength, muscle size, and recovery. And that's this randomized, prospective, double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial. That's terrific for all of you who are maybe losing your muscle mass, maybe your body's shrinking a bit, maybe your muscle tone is down, maybe you don't have the strength you once had. So take ashwagandha, A-S-H, ash, wag, W-A-G, anda, ANDHA, ashwagandha, the root. And in this study, it even relieved arthritis better than medication. So it's terrific. It's loaded with superoxide dismutase, catalase, glutathione peroxidase, and it can decrease blood cortisol levels by up to 26%. And people who are chronically stressed, it boosts your immune function, your endocrine function, your mental functioning, and even enhances libido. All of those are terrific. And this was an 8-week study of this important Ayurvedic herb. So you should have it. You should use it. It's been around for over 4,000 years and is a major part of our health. So how do you know if you need ashwagandha? Well, it's considered the most important adaptogens in Ayurvedic system of medicine, much like ginseng is in the Chinese medical system. It works in suppressing pain of any sort, and the good results have been seen in rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, gout, sciatica. It works as an anti-inflammatory, helps in reducing swelling and restoring blood supply, and it helps with lymphedema, helps with goiter. It has great healing potential for wounds and injuries, and it helps in promoting calmness and mental satisfaction. It helps in relieve the feeling of numbness and burning sensation in extremities, and it helps in providing nourishment to the brain for its better function and greater ability to work. And it revitalizes your body, decreases untimely fatigue due to weak body strength. So those are some of the reasons to use it. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
A man to do, oh baby, I'll sacrifice for you, I'll even do wrong for you, oh baby, every minute, every hour, I'm gonna shower you with love and affection, look out, it's coming in your direction,
nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. There's a silent epidemic killing white American women. According to Crawford Kiljan, I want to cite this to you because I've seen this myself. Crawford says, a momentous new report took up 6 pages in a recent issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I gave you the title of the report. This was done at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Health and International Affairs at Princeton. And they presented a calm account of a social, political, and ethnic disaster that has struck the United States, but no other industrialized nation apart from the countries of the former Soviet bloc. In the 15 years between 1998 and 2013, 500,000 Americans died before they should have. They were middle-aged white people, and they argued that they have not seen this before. For some white Americans born between 1961 and 70, something's gone wrong. They grew up in a time that should have been wonderful for them, and yet in 1998, some members of this age group began to sicken and die. It wasn't dramatic. The rest of the American population, like that of other rich countries, saw their life expectancies grow at 2% a year, including black Americans, who are still dying in greater absolute numbers than white Americans. But these people died when they should be alive. And this was a cohort's mortality began to rise at 0.5% a year. Not much, but it has continued year after year. By 2013, that meant that nearly 500,000 white Americans were dead who shouldn't have been. Quote, the post-1999 episode of midlife death in the United States is historically and geographically unique, at least since 1950, end quote. That's what they said. Okay, why? Why do 500,000 Americans die, white mainly women? Quote, three causes, suicide, drug and alcohol poisoning, and chronic liver diseases and cirrhosis, end quote. Now, other causes like diabetes barely rose above 10 deaths per 100,000. Lung cancer from smoking actually fell from 30 to 27 per 100,000. But chronic liver disease rose sharply, as did suicide and poisonings, soared from perhaps 2 to 30 per 100,000. And who is dying? Quote, the turnaround in mortality for white non-Hispanics was driven primarily by increasing death rates for those with a high school degree. And so all three educational groups saw increases in death. So it didn't matter whether you graduated or didn't, whether you went to college or didn't. They're dying. And they're saying this is a phenomenon. I don't. Let me explain why. When you've counseled as many people as I have at all ages, and when you get as much feedback coming in as I do, then you begin to see patterns. And what I've seen is this. When my generation, the baby boomers, were graduating from high school, and we looked at the world ahead of us, it was an extraordinarily exciting time. More often than not, you would stay, most people stayed within a community where they grew up. You had a sense of the commons. Everyone knew everyone. You had a support system. And it was the first the family, then friends, then relatives out far away from the immediate family, but you were still connected. The people you went to school with, if you went to college together, you frequently would come back into the same community. That's where you worked. There were three jobs available for every person who wanted a job. As a result, people were able to negotiate better standards of living because we didn't have debt. Mind you, we didn't have credit cards. We didn't have cell phones. We actually looked at each other in the eyes when we spoke, and you were held accountable for what you said and what you did. If you didn't care, I can assure you someone else did. So we didn't have school teachers being beaten to a pulp, threatened by the parents of kids that the teacher may say, you know, Jimmy's kind of acting out, and suddenly they get smacked in the mouth. Don't tell me about my kid. He's perfect. No, your kid's a brat. He's selfish and spoiled and angry, and he's bringing that to the school. No teacher would say that today, because suddenly there'd be a demonstration outside the school wanting that teacher fired or put into a rubber room. So the teachers have lost control of the environment. Many kids going to school are being dumbed down. They may come from well-motivated families who want their kids to succeed, and yet the school does a floating standard. And so as a result, an A student, by motivation, inclination, and aptitude, is suddenly studying at a C level because the kid that doesn't want to study or is not that bright is given a C. So in New York, they want every kid to pass because they want everyone to feel good about themselves, I guess, or because it aligns with their politics. But the reality is we have learned from all subsequent generations to teach people how to take tests but not to develop critical thinking. Well, when we had critical thinking, we knew how to transcend limitations and barriers in the real world. If you don't have critical thinking, then you adapt. You don't transcend anything. And then you end up adapting to a selfish apathetic way of looking at life. You don't care. And yet there are kids who do care, are kids who are part of society and are a healthy member of it, but a lot aren't, because a lot of the parents aren't, and they don't care. So now one day you come to a different environment, you integrate into that environment, you socialize in that environment, you start to share some common values in that environment, and still it looks good. But now you've got debt. You've got debt because you got credit. You can buy anything you want, even if you can't afford it, or if your credit stinks because someone's going to give you a credit card. So people began to buy houses who couldn't afford them, whose income clearly wasn't in line with with what would happen if those bills were due. And we had this kind of idea that debt is a good thing. Debt is not an asset. You cannot make debt an asset. That's economic alchemy. When we were growing up, we prided ourselves in how well we saved. If we wanted something, we put it on layaway. We had to resist that urge for, I want it now. I remember having to deliver papers. My older brother was a paper boy. I became a paper boy. And every day, I'd be out there delivering papers. You make only a nickel per house, but at the end of 2 years, I was able to buy a Schwinn bike or cut grass. But it wasn't, we didn't feel entitled that somehow someone should always be there to cover for our mistakes, excuse our indiscretions, and to be a social net if we decide to do a high dive off a building because we were confused about life. Now, ours was the last generation to be parented by the best generation. It's over now. Today, the parents should think well about, when you look at your kid, how much of you is in your kid? How much of your weaknesses, how much of your dark side, how much of your fears, limitations, insecurities, your arrogance, your narcissism, how much of you is there and is that causing an impairment in your child? Or how much of your graciousness, how much of your consideration, how much of your empathy, how much of your social connection to care about others because they're good parents and those good parents are giving good messages to their children who are then becoming an active and constructive part of society, but they're not the majority. We have an epidemic of dysfunctional parenting. And so one day, someone meets a crisis in life, doesn't have the perfect relationship, and decides, I'm in too much pain, so they start drinking, or they overeat, or they take drugs. And what do you think is the outcome when a person no longer can face the reality of each day and deal with it in a positive and spiritual way? Oh, did I forget that we start to eliminate the word spiritual development from our discussion? And so as a result, people don't have the support system that we once had. They don't have the ability to have people to talk with them about life as it is. And so a lot of kids just tap out. And then we do something else. We start to diagnose them with diseases that don't exist, like ADD and ADHD, and we give them Ritalin. And now they're wired. It's like giving them methamphetamine. And there are 11 million of them on these drugs. And we think that's normal. In fact, kids today think something's wrong with them if they haven't been diagnosed because Johnny looks out the window. Well, we all looked out the window in my generation. You know, if we were bored, we were bored. But today, if you're bored, the signs of boredom can end up manifesting in a diagnosis. We were taught to go to bed at a reasonable period of time. Today, there is no limit when a kid will go to bed, and when they do, they've got their cell phones to their head or they're in front of a computer screen, both of which are emitting the electromagnetic pulses, which we know scientifically with over 40 major studies can impact the brain and the neurons and the chromosomes in the brain. We're overheating the brain. We're causing massive brain inflammation. And then when the kid sleeps too little and doesn't get a full night's sleep, they wake up, they're exhausted. So they take caffeine and sugar. Now, guess what happens to your biochemistry when you have had a jolt of sugar and caffeine in the morning? Now tell Jimmy, stay seated. And Jimmy feels like he has akesthesia. He can't sit still. It's not because his brain chemical imbalance. It's because his biochemistry is jolted with 400 milligrams of caffeine. And so we overdiagnose, we overtreat. It's profitable. We stigmatize. It's profitable. And then we teach people how to take tests, but not critical thinking. It's profitable. And then one day, when things don't go right, the person's now in their 30s or 40s, and they've got so much sugar, so much high fructose corn syrup, that they have a unique epidemic that affects up to 40% of the adult population. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. We never had that growing up. What's that from? High fructose corn syrup or alcohol. Because the later generations learn you can bury your sorrows in alcohol or drugs or prescription drugs or overeating. So there shouldn't be a surprise, because when you help a person and you let them redefine their life based upon honoring their true spiritual self, and you are there as a support system, not to criticize them, but to help guide them in the choices they're making, then lo and behold, a person detoxifies, cleanses, rejuvenates, the liver's rejuvenated, their mind is rejuvenated, and then they go on with their life. But they're the architect of their life now, and they're happy with that. So the problem exists, and the best that the National Academy of Sciences can do is define the problem, but it cannot offer the solution, because to do so would itself be to go against everything that controls our society. Special interest groups, lobbyists, front groups that would be all over those people in a heartbeat if they said, hey, stop eating the fast food meals, the french fries, the hot dogs, the hamburgers, the sodas, the coffee. Stop watching these reality shows and watch dysfunctional people denigrate each other, attack each other, deal in the worst of human nature, and that's what we're flooded with. But maybe I missed it. Maybe there's a bunch of reality shows showing happy people doing positive things. Did I miss that? No. There's a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. So the worst human behavior is exploited. The more the media exploits it, the more people buy it. The more violent the sport, the more extreme the sport, the more people get some form of titillation from it. What kind of reasonable person would watch someone in a death-defying act, knowing full well that it's not going to enhance anyone's sense of life, watching someone do something that is irresponsible? And then what does that mean? What will then get their attention the next time? You start building on it, becomes more and more extreme. So that's just to respond to that statement. Now, in studio in New York City, we have two people, both activists. One is a journalist, highly respected, many articles published, Sharam Willems. And Sharam is from West Virginia, and she has done a lot of work trying to bring to New Yorkers' attention the politics behind the changing of Washington Square Park by New York University and its enormous power. And she's written a lot of articles on that. But also joining her is my brother Stephen, who for more than 30 years has been a major advocate, a volunteer for the small businesses to help them survive. Also to try to introduce legislation before the town council, the city council, that would at least allow a small business a chance to stay in a neighborhood. Now, on the Upper West Side, you don't have the small businesses you once had. Instead, you have drugstores, banks, mall stores. But what makes a neighborhood unique and wonderful are the small individual businesses that help support a whole community. Nice to have you both with me.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Now, Steve, let's start with you. First, to the audience who may not know the problem of what it is to be a small business person, the largest employers in New York City are the small business people. They're the backbone of people having a job, and yet they're the ones who are at the bottom of the totem pole. They have the least power. Tell about the story and give us some of the numbers of how many small businesses have gone out of business, and yet the public doesn't know it.
Okay. The root cause of a long, successful business to close is when their lease expires. In New York City, unlike residential tenants, the commercial tenants have absolutely no rights. Their future and the future of their employees is solely in the hands of the landlords. Now, with all the speculation going on in real estate, what the government of New York City has done is they've created the perfect environment worldwide to come and invest in real estate. Well, one of the victims of that perfect environment, profitable environment, are the small business owners. Because these guys who now own the property and want huge profits, they don't care if these guys go out of business. They don't care how long they've been there. So they're closing. If you are a long-established business in New York City and your lease is up, you have a death sentence. You're a dead man walking in New York City. And it isn't just Manhattan. It started in Manhattan. It's in every borough. Last year, the number one borough that led in court evictions of warrants was the Bronx. It was a staggering 30%. Why? Because these speculators are moving all over. They go into an area that's spatially low income. They buy some property. They kick out everybody. They put the tenants, commercial tenants, on month-to-month leases. They literally have become indentured servitude agreements. That's what the leases are. So we've reached a tipping point in New York that if you're a small business person, you can no longer make a reasonable profit. You can't pay these landlords exorbitant rents, pay their property taxes, and pay a decent wage and still stay in business. And so we came up with and as everybody knows what the problem is, but what they should know is that there's a very simple solution, and that's a bill that we wrote 30 years ago, which basically gave them rights, the business owners' rights to equal to the landlord, to renew their leases for 10 years, and they could give them a right to negotiate fair lease terms. If they couldn't reach an agreement, then they would go to arbitration, which is used by everybody today. Sports, industry, everybody uses arbitration. So we have the crisis, the high exorbitant rents. We have the solution. And yet we lack the political will at City Hall. And the reason why is because of the real estate control through campaign contributions of our elected officials. And regardless of their claim to be progressive and please elect us, we're going to go in there and make a new direction from Bloomberg, and we're going to pass progressive legislation, and we're going to stand up to all these spatial interests, and we're going to give everybody rights. Well, it's not true. They're not doing it. And this bill should be passed tomorrow. If they lived up to their campaign promises and stand up and do the right thing, this bill would pass tomorrow. Every small business in every community.
What is the title of it?
It's called the Small Business Job Survival Act. And the real estate industry have bottled it up in committee now for 6 years.
What can people in this audience do to help unbottle this?
Well, you can log on to savenycjobs.org, and there you will find the links to stories like Sharon's going to tell you about the problem and put pressure. You can sign a petition. You can contact your council member. That's the most important thing, is that these council people have to be told by the community that, you know, you have to find a solution.
But this is New York City. Most people here care about their career, their standard of living. They don't care about social issues. It's a very selfish environment here in the city. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Yes, but here's the thing. It's no longer a social issue. It's an economic issue. And I'll give you an example. Right now, everybody's saying, let's do the $15 minimum wage. Well, for the past 20 years, everyone's wage in New York City has been determined by the landlord. How much he's going to charge for the rent determines how much profit the business is going to make, and that'll determine what kind of wage. All of these factors, the taxes on property, that's determined by this speculation. It's now an economic issue, and if they don't save the small businesses in New York, we lose them. New York is going to go into a major recession. I mean, that's just a fact. You cannot lose the job creators, which are the small businesses.
I agree with you. I'm just looking as a pragmatist that I don't believe that the average New Yorker will go out of their way to contact their legislator. I wish they would, Steve. I don't see it happening. And even on the Upper West Side, the most concentrated power and profit and income group in the world lives from 57th Street to 115th Street, from River to Park. That's the greatest amount of successful people on the planet in one space. Ask how many of those people would go out of their way to call a legislator, write a legislator, read a piece. You have a small number, but you're not going to get by with small number. Give the name of the bill again and the website people can go to.
It's the Small Business Job Survival Act. The website is savenycjobs.org. And I'm going to disagree with you, and I'll tell you why. Because every New Yorker can name 6 to 10 of their favorite businesses that have gone out, and they have passed a tipping point where they are tired of losing their businesses. And I think that now when they know that there's a solution sitting there,
okay,
they're going to demand from their legislators to pass this bill.
I've seen a little different perspective. I've seen when a little newsstand downtown that was there for 50 years and they were getting hiked up in their rent. The people were concerned, but they found another place to buy their newspaper. A restaurant closes, has been there in the village for 60, 70 years. They'll find another restaurant. The trouble is New Yorkers are used to this cycle of life and death. And so they'll talk about the good old neighborhood, the good old place they used to go into, but they're not there to defend it as they should. Because if New Yorkers did what you suggested, even a small percentage, they would put enough pressure upon their legislators that this would stop. The trouble is, it's only generally activists. Activists are out there. They have a commitment to their community. They're hardwired differently. But the average person's concerned about today, right now, traffic, which, you know, presence, whatever they're doing today, it's not caring about that small business. And you know who told me this? Saul Zabar. You know, Saul's a friend for a long time. He owns Zabar's. And I think he's 87 now, and he stops by all the time we chat. And he's the one who told me that time and time again, he was concerned by how many small businesses were closing, but he couldn't get the people to, you know, to say something. And I'll bet if even his store was threatened with closure, which it won't be, he owns, you know, the whole block, but if it were, people would be concerned. But would they actually go out of their way? Well, that's a question. Sharon.
I think it has reached critical mass now. And some people say to me, well, I don't own a store, so why should I be concerned about your articles or whatever? And I say, well, if you don't mind spending 25% more on your groceries because your grocery store has to pay that much more to the landlord than he should be paying, then you don't need to be concerned. So you kind of need to guide people and let them know that indeed they are being affected really in a horrible way, and then they'll maybe do something. But I do agree that people are apathetic, and one reason they're apathetic is because there are a lot of activists and ordinary people who have tried to move legislature along and call their council members and do this and that and petition and nothing happens. And they just get lip service. You know, they don't get real, you know, real action, real legislation that's going to change things.
I agree with that. I look at what happened with Silver, who was the head of the Senate, most powerful person behind the governor in New York State, now found guilty, he's going to go to prison. And that the Democrat head of the Senate, also him and his son found guilty. Now, those are two of the most powerful people, but look how many decades they engaged in their corruption, mm-hmm. cronyism, before they were finally brought down. And if you cleaned out Albany, and if you cleaned out the local city hall of every corrupt person, you'd have a janitor left in both buildings. I don't trust any politician. I don't. And I'm just looking at it. So New Yorkers are highly intelligent. They're motivated in their own life. It's tough to succeed in New York. It's one of the toughest places in the world. But it's really tough if you're a small business person. So then you ask, who's on your side if you're a small business person? And it's your the people who shop from you. But then you have to get them to organize. And one of the things I have not seen, Steve, is I have not seen when I go into stores, whether it's the local optometry, like Jay up at Pildy's, who I've known for years, I haven't seen them having petitions in their window.
You're right.
And if they not, if, look, it comes down to this. If you're a small business person and you're getting hammered, and we're small business people, And I just had a landlord want $20,000 more per month from me, $20,000 more per month. And my office used to be, they wanted the same amount of rent for an office. I've moved my office because of that. That the people, and I'm in a one-story walk-up versus downstairs. They want the same price as if I was downstairs, you know, a retail business. And I say, why? Because we can get it. If you're not going to pay it, someone else will. So for every time you walk up and down Broadway and you see a shuttered store that says for rent, and you see, my goodness, from 89th and Broadway to 63rd and Broadway, which I walk all the time to go to films down there, I'll see 15 to 30 different empty storefronts. But there's always someone willing to go in there and try to make their go of it using their life savings or debt, or whatever it is. They have to work together. If you don't have stores working together, then one by one, they will all end up out of business.
Well, this is the reason I'm here. I don't disagree with you. I mean, there's no better example than Mayor de Blasio of flipping and saying one thing. In 2008, when we introduced this bill, the number one voice in New York City to pass this bill was then Councilman Bill de Blasio. He showed up at rallies. He pounded on the desk that it was an outrage that the immigrant businesses were being extorted. There was an outrage that they were on these short leases, that he was going to do something about it. He was going to take the city in a new direction from Bloomberg. He was elected Mr. Progressive. He kept every policy of Bloomberg, every anti-small business policy of Bloomberg intact. So we know that what politicians say and who they really represent and is two different things. But the fact is the small businesses, because they have no rights, will never be putting signs up in their windows, will never be out there leading the charge because they're afraid. When you have no rights and you hope the landlord gives you a decent rent, you're not going to be putting up signs and banners. It has to come from the community. I mean, that's the bottom line. If they don't stand up for their businesses and be the voice of their businesses, because the government's not going to be a voice of the business, they're a voice of the real estate. De Blasio is not going to be a voice. We know that. The store owners can't because they're terrified. They have no rights. There's only one last chance. And when I say last chance, if they don't pass this bill within 6 months, then every small business independent will become extinct in New York City. They cannot survive. That's a fact.
I agree with that, Steve. Now let's see if they do. My hope is that they do, because we engage in demonstrations all the time, probably five or six per year, major ones, whether it's March Against Monsanto or speaking out against psychiatry or closing Indian Point. And I see the same group of people. I do not see the average New Yorker, even though if Indian Point had an accident, 20 million people would be affected. I don't see 2,000 people showing up, let alone 2 million. If you can't get 1/100th of 1% of a population that's directly impacted by an activity that they should support, then you're in the wrong place. So I'm advocating people now in this audience move elsewhere. New York no one in the world ever moves to New York for health and happiness. That doesn't exist. You move to New York for career success and, you know, and advantage in what you need and standard of living. The other things happen elsewhere. So I'm advocating people go to where, A, you don't have zoning. B, you don't have a tyrannical local government over you and corrupt. And because people think they have to be in New York. And there was a time when you could, when we had a viable middle class, where unions were powerful, where you could actually do something and not be burdened to death or taxed to death. That's gone. We don't have that today. I wish we did. But because I've been in business since I came to New York City on the Upper West Side. I'm constantly struck by the idea that no landlord has ever, that I've dealt with, cared about whether I succeeded or failed, because they're always having someone else. They don't personalize it. They say, look, I bought the building. I own the building. You'll pay what the market will give, and we determine what the market is. And if you don't want to be there, leave. You can say, look, I'm healing people. I'm helping people. I'm feeding people. They don't care. Landlords don't care. And from their business point of view, that's their prerogative. That's their right. You know, but
they forget the other side of the equation. You're still dealing with human beings and communities. And in New York, there'll always be someone willing to take a chance looking into everyone else that failed. Do you think a reasonable person would listen to you, Steve, knowing that you've been at the heart of this, the vortex, saying that between 3.2 and 3.6 million New Yorkers have lost their jobs in the last 20 years because of closure of small businesses? Over 450,000 small businesses have closed. Over 1,000 per month have closed. And why? A person's going to think, wow, that's a tough environment. And yet, they won't. They'll think, let me get it up there. I'm going to give it a shot. And so my hope is you're right. My hope is people listening right now will contact the city council and demand that this bill be brought up for a vote. And then I would hope that you would go around all the businesses and have a demonstration down at City Hall with every small business that would be affected. Final thoughts, Sharon?
Well, short of leaving New York City, and I understand that sentiment, a regular normal person can actually go on to Take Back NYC, and they have a tweeting every day. They let you know which council member to tweet. It makes it easy, you know, for you to do, and the more the merrier. So that's one thing you can do. Go on Facebook and join that group.
Sharon's modest. She wrote one of the best articles, and it's on our site, savenycjobs.org, called the Pope. What would the Pope do? And it's an article about the morality, that there are some issues that elected officials have to take a step back and forget the spatial interest. What's the right moral thing to do? And the Pope's message was very simple. You protect the people in need that was caused by greed. And
can you show me an example of that working in the United States anywhere at the federal, state, or local governments by any politician? Can you show that person? I'll invite them on the show.
Well, let me tell you something. listeners out there,
politics is purely mercenary.
Read that article. It's right there on the front page. And make a comment. Do a like. Make a comment. That's a great.
And share on your social media.
Put it on the social media.
Okay, give the website again.
Oh.
Save NYCjobs.org, and the name of the article is
What Would Francis Do? Voting on the SBJSA.
Okay.
And I must say, The Villager has led the charge in this, and they've done an excellent job.
The Villager's publisher and managing editor are very ethical people.
Yeah.
And we need a lot more of them.
Right.
Thank you both for coming in. And that's just to let the people who were listening last week understand that the issue of not seeing the invisible part of the formula of building high rises on speculation, going into neighbors on speculation, disrupting through gentrification, and then the people are buying apartments, not even living in them. We're in a bubble, and the bubble is being manifested by extraordinarily greedy people, and the same people who caused the original real estate bubble in the 2000s are here again. There's a commercial real estate bubble. There's a retail real estate bubble. There's a home real estate bubble. There is a debt equity bubble. There's hedge fund bubbles, equity partnership bubbles. There's $25 trillion owed by corporate America. And that's why I gave you the name of the corporation, how many employees they had, and how much debt they had, to show you all those companies are going to fail. Because now interest rates are going to go up, people are not going to be able to afford money, and the sectors that were impacted are not going to get their money back. So you're looking at 5 million jobs being lost. And if you don't think that doesn't impact the economy at the local level, it sure does. Well, New York City is also being impacted at the local level as well. So let's help the small business person. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening.